And you've been 7 years, so I know you can't talk about your clients, but have you had clients who have discovered sexual trauma in their past through this method, through somatics?
Yes. Yeah? Yes. Yeah, I had a profound experience with a Catholic client, Catholic Hispanic client, where she came in for PTSD, and I have my clients close their eyes and go, so it's also visual, so I have them go into their body, and so once the person's in their body, all types of things happen. People have had visualizations, memories, they hear spirits, all types of things start happening that are very non-linear and very poetic in nature. It's almost like we call it a dream state. So they're conscious, they're awake, but it's also a dream state that they get into. And so I had one example where, this client all of a sudden had this image of, let me just think how it went. I don't remember how she got there. Hold on one sec. She did. So I had a client who didn't know she was molested by her brother as a child. She found out later through her whole family told her later, but only after she discovered it through therapy. But how did she get there? I'll tell you what I do remember. So one time we were doing the somatic intervention. And she all of a sudden saw herself in a dark room, and she felt very cold, very scared, and very lonely. And she had a quasi-PTSD attack in the moment, so I had to, really bring her away. So as much as I want to bring people into their somatic experience and their memories, I also don't want to bring them farther than they can tolerate. So I had to, do the equivalent of splashing cold water in her face. And so that was the beginning of her exploring these things that were beneath her mind. And she's just like, I don't know what that was. I don't know where that's coming from. And so session after session, we kept on going back in, and little things would emerge. And so one time I had her, I also do a little art. And so one time I had her draw, and it showed her brother over her bed. And each time I did it, there were different non-linear expressions. One was a visualization, one was an art piece, and over time, it became clear to her that she was abused by her brother, sexually abused by her brother, and he forced her to do certain things, and and sometimes, people say therapists are, a lot of people say therapists are, there's a syndrome they call it. I forgot the name of it. False memory syndrome. Thank you. So I was like, is this false memory syndrome? And then sure enough, coincidentally, but not coincidentally, it all came out from all of her siblings somehow ended up telling her, yeah, she was the baby of the family, and everyone else was old enough to remember the molestation, but she was so young that she didn't remember, and everyone kept it a secret from her all these years. And so it was like this huge earth-shattering process for her to not only have it come up through somatic intervention, but then have it confirmed from the whole family.
Yeah, that's pretty unusual. The second part's pretty unusual.
That was unusual. Yes, that was very validating to me too as a therapist and to her, because but yes, usually the families keep it a secret forever.
Yeah. Just as a side point, false memory syndrome, I mean, I don't know if you've done any research into them, have you?
No, I haven't. I just read references to it. But no.
It's been pushed pretty hard again now, even though it was invalidated. I don't know how thoroughly, obviously not very thoroughly, but the people who set it up were known pedophilia advocates and
uh-huh.
child abusers themselves, not all of them, uh-huh. but sure. some of the key players. So,
sure.
I mean, yeah, it's as fishy as you might guess it would be.
And sure.
the whole notion of, you know, memories being generated is being pushed quite hard. There's this Elizabeth Loftus is pushing it, and I don't know what to think about that. I mean, I guess we are suggestible and what have you, but I guess this is the thing about the body doesn't lie. The mind right. can. And again, this is, I think, right. this was addressed in Lucid View in a not in as comprehensible way as I would like now, but that the way that we interpret experiences mentally is always going to have an element of distortion in them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true the more kind of non-consensual they are. And so Lucid View is about UFOs and
right.
ancient conspiracies and occultism, and that was my focus then in terms of non-consensual reality. Now my focus is more on organized abuse and something that's very sordid and mundane and doesn't really require any kind of fantastic element, except, I mean, it does, of course, overlap because of the, you know, organized ritual abuse and all the rest of it. It does overlap, but the base reality of a child that's being interfered with by an older child or by an adult, there's nothing fantastic about that. It's just that it's traumatic and it's taboo. And the combination of trauma and taboo, I mean, even trauma alone, there's this very interesting book I'd recommend called A Most Accursed Religion, When God Becomes a Trauma, by Greg Mogensen. And his premise is that because by definition trauma is something that is too large for us to mentally comprehend or process, it takes on qualities of the divine to us. Because
that is, you know, fascinating. Yeah. Tell me more, because this example I just gave you, I'll tell you in a minute, that actually happened with this client, and I'll tell you in a minute, but I want to hear more about the concept. Trauma takes on qualities of the divine. Tell me more.
Yeah. Well, I have to refer to you to the book and also to Prisoner of Infinity, which is about Whitley Strieber, which is all about this, you know, how his childhood trauma got turned into a, you know, a massive literary industry about alien abduction, essentially.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't have to be the literal divine in terms of gods, although
sure.
You know, traditionally it has been that. It can be, I mean, the satanic is also a divine thing. Like if the devil mm-hmm. existed, the devil would be a god, right? We're talking about an archetypal mm-hmm. entity. So not divine in the sense of positive, but the divine in the sense of just something transcendental. And mm-hmm. so the other, you know, factor here besides, and it's related, or another way of saying what I was saying about what the mind can't comprehend that is overwhelming to the mental faculties and also physically overwhelming, then gets turned into something divine, is the dissociative mechanism. So when
yes.
when we're overwhelmed as organisms, and if it's early on, the mind hasn't even fully formed yet, the
right.
constructed mental identity self hasn't, then we dissociate, we disembody, and we
right.
go into this disembodied realm in which, I mean, what we think of as fantasy, but fantasy with a PH, because it's very real to consciousness or to the awareness within that experience, because it has to be real enough for them to block out the experience that's happening to them physically.
Right.
So then that, you know, how we recontextualize a terrible trauma, a sexual trauma, whatever it is, into a dissociated fantasy or a dissociative fantasy, we draw upon those deeper symbols or deeper images. I guess it would be images, wouldn't it? But the, what Jung called archetypes.
You know, yes,
I mean, that's just a word, right? But whatever that is that Jung was talking about, I think that they're part of our survival toolkit that we can we can either generate or access images that already exist in some collective space, or a bit of both, and superimpose those visionary states onto the trauma. So if we remember anything, we remember some weird, you know, dream visitation, or some, you know, clown figure, or some alien, or and then of course the third factor is that there's a need for the child to see their abuser as benevolent, because it's too threatening to really recognize that the what they're doing is malign, because it is life threatening. But if they can tell themselves that, or no, it's not telling themselves, but if somehow they can reconceptualize it so that they're the one who is bad, and that the abuser is just doing something for their good because they're benevolent, then that actually is much safer for them, although it's of course much more damaging psychologically.
Yes, yes, those are all very core ideas in trauma work, and making the abuser good and making self bad.
Yeah.
You know, this client, and this is right to your point, I use visualization sometimes to, you know, I work with people's nervous systems. So if, you know, I want to keep them what they call within the window of tolerance. I don't want them to get too activated, but I want them to get a little activated. If there's no activation, if they're not feeling anything, the work doesn't work. But if they get too activated, then I'm re-traumatizing them. And so this one time she was very activated, so I supported her going to visualization, and she went up to the heavens and she saw Jesus. I was like, oh, this is great. She's seeing Jesus. She's Catholic. She's Hispanic. She, you know, this is going to be a great symbol for her. And she starts telling me she's getting scared, and she sees herself coming closer and closer to Jesus, and he's putting her hands out to her. And I've been doing this for 7 years, and I don't think I've ever seen someone have that big of a panic attack in my life. The woman started shaking and convulsing, and I immediately stopped what we were doing. And again, I had her splash cold water in her face. I gave her food. I gave her water. She came back to planet Earth. And I processed it with a lot of therapists, and I've never understood what the hell happened. And now I think you just gave me the missing link. Like, she probably transmuted her abuse experience into some archetypical imagery that was also skewed into a benevolent archetypical imagery, and to get away from the original assault.
Right. Have you heard about or read Donald Cowshed?
Donald who?
Cowshed, The Inner World of Trauma.
No. Donald Cowshed?
Yeah, well, I'll send you the link, but he's a main source for Prison Room Infinity, and it's this amazing book. It's case studies with his interpretations. It's a combination of his own analysis and understanding of the phenomenon with actual case studies. And specifically, he, I don't know if he coined it, the term, or if he adopted it, but The Guardian is what he talks about, the psychic self-care system that, you know, protects us from trauma when we're too psychically unformed to process it, just what I was talking about. And so The Guardian is this figure that is created in the psyche. I mean, it often is created as an actual figure, an internal presence that is actually, its function is to protect the organism, the psychological organism, from from shutting down, from being annihilated by the trauma. So it is a benevolent yes. figure to begin with, but it's like the demiurge in the, in the Gnostic thing. It becomes a jealous god. It becomes, because it gets installed there, like a permanent feature of the psyche, it continues to intervene or intercede and to control and to protect, in quotes, the person, even, you know, when there's no longer any need for it.
Sure.
And it will also, and because it's, I mean, what we were touching on earlier about the way that the trauma gets internalized is that the child perceives the punishment as deserved and that the abuser right. is benevolent. And so they right. internalize the abuse. And right. so the flip side of the guardian, and this is very complex to talk about, but I think it's related to cutting, when people cut themselves in order to dissociate. It's a way to relieve unbearable psychic pressure.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
They brings them into the body, but they're actually harming themselves. So I think that that's a more literal kind of enactment of this internal thing, whereby when a person needs to dissociate, the guardian will assist them with that. And one of the ways it will do that is by presenting its punishing face. It has the two faces. It has the benevolent, right. you know, nurturing, protecting face that's saving them, and then it also has the ruthless, abusive face, and whichever face, you know, it functions for, in order to activate that dissociation strategy, then that's the form the guardian takes. So
yes, wow.
Because that is in all the archetype, the symbolism and the symbology that I was exploring in Lucid View and in our religions and all the rest of it. You've got Christ and the Antichrist, and when you look at it with a more of a psychological eye, they seem to be kind of the same thing. You know, it's like two sides of one archetype. So, it's just us, really. You know, I mean, once the trauma has been done and we carry it with us into our life, the struggle for wholeness is just within us.
Yes. Yes. I'm loving, this is new for me. This is new. I've done three separate trauma trainings and I have not heard this yet. So the use of archetypical imagery, and I'm really loving it. And I'm also thinking about myself, how, you know, my parents experienced a lot of rough stuff in my family, and, I was a hyper religious child, extremely, like I took on a lot of, within the Jewish lineage, there's something called the Musar movement. Have you ever heard of the Musar movement?
No.
So it's an old Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox movement. Not usually, it's a bunch of super intense ascetic practices, which Judaism is not known for, but I was attracted to it as a child. And just putting together that it makes sense from this perspective why I would have been attracted to these extremely intense ascetic practices, and what you said about how it has two faces, how the demigod, so to speak, has two faces, is really speaking to me, because I turned to God so intensely as a child, but also would hate on myself for violating any of the tenets that I adopted. And I would look in the mirror and scream at myself that God hates me because I violated this, that, and the other. And so I imagine, looking back, that was one of my unconscious motivations for turning to that version of God, was to protect myself from all the trauma I experienced. That's I never put those dots together, I'm embarrassed to say.
Sure. So were you not raised in that? I mean, did you to some extent adopt such intense religious fervor independently of your parents, rather than actually just be raised in it?
So it's a great question. I come from, so my dad and my grandpa was brought up, and my great grandpa and going back were super intensely religious, and a lot of those ascetic practices were in the family lineage. My grandpa left, and then I left the fold, and I, as a child, was obsessed with Judaism, and my parents were secular. And in my obsessive return to religious practice, they eventually returned themselves. Now my whole family is ultra-Orthodox, and I'm the only one who's not, extremely ironically. But it was in the family blood, if you will. But it was all me in the beginning. But I took it on very harshly, very intensely.
And so as far as you know, that wasn't due to the direct influence of anyone. Like you just sort of dug up the ancestral heritage yourself.
I mean, my parents, so it's interesting. Yes and no. My parents, it was also due to the influence of, my parents sent me to an Orthodox day school. So most of the kids were from secular families who had a sentimental attitude towards their Jewish heritage and said to themselves, gosh, I wish I didn't get a Jewish education as a child. You know, I want my kids to have it. And so my parents were in that kind of segment of the population. So they sent us to a Jewish day school. And so I was influenced by those rabbis. But so they always said, even from nursery school, I was going to something Jewish. But I was always pulled to, they have a picture of me 3 years old. I'm wearing a prayer shawl and a yarmulke. You know, at three, I don't even know where the hell I got it from. You know what I mean? Like, I would walk around with it. So I'm not sure what the mechanism, psychic mechanism, directly was.
Body breaks, but then your body is fine. You know I'm open to yours, and I'm open to mine. Your body aches, and that ache takes its time. But you'll get over yours, and I'll get over mine. And the sun will shine, and the moon will rise. Body calls, yeah, your body calls out. It whispers at first, but it ends with a shout. Your body burns, yeah, your body burns strong. Until mine is with yours, then mine will burn on. My flesh sings out, it sings, Mama, come put me out. Stays, then your body moves on. But you know I'd really rather not dwell on when yours will be gone. Still within the dark, there'll always be a little shine, one tiny spark, forever yours and mine.
Well, yeah, that's what I was getting to. And what are your views on circumcision then, as a trauma therapist, somatic therapist?
Yeah, well, I've come full circle. I mean, today, I am against it. But I, even a year ago, I might have said something differently. The more I read books like yours and like Jason Kristoff is pretty, he's not as articulate as you are. You have very precise languaging. But you and Jason Kristoff have a lot in common in terms of views, I think. And so he writes a lot about circumcision. It's really gotten to me. And I think that I have a lot of internalized sexual shame to the point where my libido since I was 18 has been lower than it should be. One of the many mechanisms I think that caused that was circumcision, and so I'm very against it now. I do think it causes trauma, and it's a terrible thing to do to a child when they're 8 days old.
I certainly agree. I wasn't exposed to that, but I think I was exposed to something possibly even more traumatic. And I would say that the same. One of the same results, as in unnaturally low libido, except when I'm asleep. I know it's there; like it really kicks in when I'm asleep. But in terms of being able to access it while I'm conscious and in a place of intimacy, I mean, I've really had to discover through marriage that the more intimacy there is, the harder it is for me to access my libido,
sure.
Which is very key to understanding.
Sure.
Yes. So, and what, I mean, this may be a whole new departure, but I think it is on point that, because you were talking about your ancestral heritage in terms of religion, and, the hijacking of the libido, I mean,
yes.
We segued right into that with the circumcision. And I don't know if Jason Kristoff writes about this, but I think that circumcision is just a rare case of an occult sexual abuse ritual with a specific aim that has been, made socially acceptable.
Right.
And that there are other rituals such as the sodomizing an infant, which I have reason to believe through the kind of therapy that you give in terms of through somatic evidence, I have reason to believe it happened to me, and I've got no other reason to believe it. Well, no, that's not true, actually, because all the research I've done into my family suggests that they were connected to those kinds of programs, but that evidence is really at odds with my childhood memories mostly and
sure.
What I think of as my family now. It's very cognitive dissonance creating. So I would say the strongest evidence I have is just somatic memories of actually physical sensations of being raised
sure.
as an infant that I've had. And I think that, and there isn't a great deal of evidence for this, but there is some. That sort of ritual and probably circumcision too, that they have to do with obviously with psychological trauma and fragmentation, but
yes.
that the aim of that has something to do with making the physical organism, the child, turning them into a receptacle for ancestral possession of some kind. It's like, because circumcision is literally a way to continue the lineage, like it's like branding with cattle, you actually brand the child with, this
right.
of the tribe. So it has that literal thing, and, the ritual sexual abuse of children is also generational and within, these circles, these groups that practice strange rituals and all the rest of it. And I think, for the same end, that it has something to do with, I'm just going to repeat what I said, really. I mean, there's a psychological phenomenon that's better documented, or even this is not very well known. Lloyd DeMouse writes about it in terms of the psychic, psychohistory and the he writes about history through a psychological lens, and he talks about poison containers and how sexual abuse is a way to turn children into containers for the psychic poisons of the abusers. And I think that the one can extend that or extrapolate further that these psychic poisons in some way are kind of a, like fragments of the abusers and even of ancestors who have died, we get a bit metaphysical here, that then possess the child and animate it in some, you know,
yes,
very real sense. And so, of course, we don't have access to our libidos, you know, as adults, or to our life force, or to our lives, really, because it is actually almost, or perhaps literally, a case of being possessed by something that is not us.
Yes.
But it is so close to us that it seems like us. I mean, in a sense, it is us.
Right.
It's our ancestors, and we are that. We are them. Yeah?
Yes.
But it's...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to finish it. It's disowned. It's what we're being possessed by isn't simply the ancestors, you know, the whole of the ancestral lineage, but the disowned fragments of them.
Right. Yeah. Right. The disowned fragments is what's being... That is what's animating us, yes. Oh my gosh, I mean, this concept is sending like, I'm having like, what am I having? I'm having kind of almost like a, not nausea move through me, but like almost after you throw up, the relief you feel, I'm having a very visceral reaction in a resonating way to what you're saying, because on a level, I am like people who knew me when I was a kid, and people who know, like, this doesn't happen too often, but people who, I am a very different Aaron that I am now than I was as a kid, and people knew me as this like religious fanatic who looked and acted autistic, and now I'm this like body-based somatic therapist who's into all these like really new agey and conspiracy theory type things. So, and the idea of ancestral possession, you know, it's funny, like, I have, my Schneider lineage is, there's a very, very famous rabbi in my lineage, I mean, famous in the ultra-Orthodox world, and all of the traits that I possessed as a child, he possessed. I read about him when I was older, after I stopped being religious. There's biographies about him, and like, I feel like I was reading about my childhood self. It was a little freaky, and his intensity and obsession with the minutiae of the law, his willingness to violently impose those on others, emotionally violently impose those on others, and I did that as a child too. It's almost like I wasn't me. It's almost like I was, not skip two generations, but it's almost like somehow I took on, either his energy or our common ancestors' energy. And, it definitely is not me. And my mother to this day, I don't really have a relationship with my parents, for a lot of reasons, but when I do talk to my mother, the only thing she says is, "I'm not me anymore." She says, "I miss the Aaron that you were," and I'm thinking now out loud that the Aaron that I was just a carbon copy of some ancestor, and the Aaron that I am now is the authentic Aaron, if that all makes sense.
It makes sense. I would put a question mark after authentic Aaron, just being me. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Say more.
Sometimes children become like their fathers, and sometimes children become the opposite of their fathers.
Sure.
But those who become the opposite of their fathers, they're still imitating their father. They're just doing it
right.
negative ways. So, so
yes.
what you've described is obviously more. It's more of a journey than that, but you've described that you were possessed ancestrally, and then you have now established an identity that is, it feels more authentically you, but mm-hmm. The reason I put the question mark is that there may be an element in that, or a very strong element even, of you doing whatever you need to do to not be ancestrally possessed.
Sure.
In, you know, overcompensatory, a sort of compensatory identity, because that's just what we do. And that, I'd say that, you know, that's phase two. And then maybe phase three is when the two cancel each other out. And then, you know, but authentic is a very big word anyway. So,
sure.
Because it implies 100% when you use it without qualification.
Yes. I very much resonate with your addition of the question mark, and thank you for your honesty around that. Yes, that would be a fair thing to say. Yes, to what degree is my current persona a function of compensation, and to what degree, you know, and obviously it's a journey, like you said. Yes, and it's fascinating because right now one of the things I do is I work for a group practice, and I see regular folks there, but I have a private practice. And in my private practice, I work with ultra-Orthodox Jews who are struggling with the intersection of their mental health and their religious identity. In so many ways, I feel like I'm doing, when I'm working with these folks, I feel like I'm working on myself and like almost as they like grieve their pain around wanting to be something other than that which their family wants them to be. I feel like I'm grieving my own stuff too. And so, and in this limbo space of, so I live in one of the, you know, Baltimore, Maryland's like one of the biggest ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities on the planet. And so it's a really weird place for me to be living right now in that regard. So, yes.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, what you're exploring here, this somatic therapy and the somatic, the possibility and the opportunity of a somatic experience of existence is really a no-identity self.
Yes, yes.
Because, you know, the body, we can identify with the body and then give it a name and turn that into an identity, but the body is an organism, you know, that is somewhat separate from its environment, but in many ways not. But that doesn't actually make it an identity per se. I think it's only when we have the element of thought. So, and of course, you know, this is a challenge for us as human beings, but it's a challenge for us right now. We're doing a podcast, so we can't rely on somatic communication because it would just be dead air.
That would be true. Yes,
but at the same time, we don't want to leave it out. Like when recently you referred to your bodily responses to what I was saying, and by talking about them, which isn't necessarily the same as referring to them by letting them speak.
Yes. Yes. Sure.
Right. That's very different.
Mm-hmm.
But to bring it to something concrete, because that. Where I'm going now could expand into science, I think. What about mannerisms? Like, you're talking about the way in which you recognized your attitudes and your personality in your ancestor. Have you noticed and have you thought about in your therapy, because I'm just thinking about it now for myself, because I have so many physical mannerisms.
Right.
My own body language, essentially. Most of which is unconscious, a lot of which is compulsive. I'm a compulsive nose picker, for example. I even do it while I'm asleep. So,
yes.
Thanks for laughing, because then it makes it feel like it's not serious, but it isn't that funny, actually. It is a.
Well, I'm laughing because I'm also a compulsive nose picker.
Okay.
So I'm resonating.
Okay. Did you mention that in an email?
No.
No, because somebody did recently, and because it's one of the things I mentioned, I'm transparent. And because it's clues, you know, all these things are clues, so I'm not going to suppress evidence just because it makes me look bad. I mean, it's fundamental to honesty, of course. So, I think it is a clue, but then there are others that are less obvious. And, you know, I'm just thinking about this now, like our experience of who we are, I would say, is a moment-to-moment experience of the organism through senses, which is what you're exploring. Like what am I in this moment? I'm an itch in my toe. I'm a churning in my stomach. I am this. I am that. Not as in now I'm going to open a franchise and identify as the guy with the churning stomach, but as in this is what is happening right now. In this awareness, right? So, but then when you talk about body armor, we haven't talked about it, but, you know, how we act as a body is of course one step removed from what we're experiencing perceptually as a body. Like there isn't necessarily, and I would say very rarely, is there a seamless flow between our perceptual sensory experience and our expression.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that relates to how we inherit ancestral mannerisms.
Sure.
We embody these compulsive behaviors that aren't, they're not sourced in our perception at the moment. By definition, they're sourced in some recurring pattern.
Right. Yes. And so in somatic psychotherapy, we actually work with gestures. And so let's say you were my client, what I would do is I would actually have you pick your nose on purpose in front of me, but I would have you do it extremely slowly so that you can witness what it's like to pick your nose and to feel what other messages might be in your body. Emotions, memories, visualizations, all the right brain type stuff that might emerge as you slowly, slowly pick your nose, because like we said earlier, these are all fragments, and the idea is to obviously make the unconscious conscious. So if picking your nose is an unconscious gesture, my goal as a somatic therapist would to make that unconscious aspect of self communicate in a conscious way.
Mm.
And
that might reveal something underneath the unconscious gestures.
Yes.
Obviously, what's in the unconscious that those gestures or those compulsions are, that they function to keep unconscious.
They function to what?
To keep it unconscious.
Yes, yes, exactly.
A tree-torn avenue after the storm put the lights out. A frozen moment all alone. No birds, no phones. A silent row of homes. No tracks in the roads yet. Still no place to go. No clouds, no show. Black is up to what's left over and lost. Colors everything. Bereaved still walks around hand in hand with memory. The two together quite a pair. Up to what's left over and lost. Colors everything. Back from 91. Thoughts of half a life ago. They
when we, they use the term sequencing in my field, if we do it, if we're just, you know, we're using that example, it could be like, you know, I often will, even right now, I'm like playing with a piece of metal and twisting it around. And so if I do that unconscious, if I'm actually sequencing out energy, and it's actually an energy loss. It's like, to use an extreme parallel, this is an extreme parallel, it'd be the equivalent of masturbation, where, you know, you can have a whole symbiotic experience, having sex with someone, or you can masturbate and unconsciously and kind of ejaculate out that energy away, and lose that energy. And so it's kind of like a, when we do something unconsciously, it's actually an energy loss, and we're not capitalizing on the potential input that's trying to speak. And
surely, so just to cut you off, surely it's, yeah. It's a potential energy loss rather than a necessarily one, because there's so many unconscious behaviors that are appropriate.
Sure,
as
sure.
As opposed
yes.
to the compulsive ones, yeah?
Yes, yes.
And if we had to think about, you know, lifting up an arm to stop ourselves falling, then we would just
right.
fall, right?
Yes, okay. Yes. They good clarification, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, sorry, I carry on.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Part of my personal practice is to really, with my clients and with myself, is to really bear witness to the mannerisms and see what's there. And so when coming back to full circle to the ancestors, I definitely have so many gestures that are and mannerisms, vocal mannerisms that are congruent with ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I have a sentimental relationship with them, like, oh, cute, I still have those things in me. Especially when I talk to ultra-Orthodox Jews, they have their own language, and so I like going into that language and intonation and hand movement with the thumb. They do this thing with their thumb and like this gesticulation. And so on one hand, I love it for sentimental purposes. On the other hand, I'm very much still trapped in that world. On a physical level that you're now mentioning, and I'm just thinking out loud, like I'm just appreciating how much I'm stuck in that world physiologically, as we're talking.
Mm. Well, it's kind of the same, although I don't have the same sort of examples that I'm aware of in terms of gestures and mannerisms, but the feeling of being trapped by my own physical gestures and mannerisms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no speaking of is an obvious example because I can't stop if I want to. But I suppose, I think the whole experience of acting unconsciously and becoming aware that we're acting unconsciously, which is kind of weirdly paradoxical and yet true, that we can do that. This has to happen. We have to become conscious of acting unconsciously.
Yes.
That there is an intensification of, not always by any means, but some of the time of the experience of being trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're recognizing, I'm recognizing that, that I'm acting unconsciously, and so you can't override the unconscious, because by the time you see it, by the time it's moving you, it's too late. You've already.
Yes. 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 That's an excellent yes. And that's definitely part, a piece of, for me, this might be a little heady, but the idea is that if we were not traumatized, we would not be disassociated, and we wouldn't have as many fragments that are unconscious. And so my fantasy is that people who miraculously got out unscathed would not have that conundrum. They would be able to anything that arose energetically in their system would be tracked and moved in healthy and in conscious ways. And I think it's just a function of, well, this is probably simplifying it, but I think it's definitely a piece of the function of having trauma from our childhoods, that we are inevitably not aware of the things that arise as they arise.
Yeah. And yet, isn't there something really exquisite in that also?
Yes.
In that we get to surprise, to be surprised by ourselves,
yes,
by our own expressions.
Yes.
Like, it seems as, yes, though when we want to lose the trauma and lose the destructive behaviors, and perhaps lose the unconsciousness in the sense that we're talking about, but we wouldn't want to lose the absolute unexpected nature of spontaneous action.
Because
then one would be in a different sort of prison where everything was foreordained by the energy from the moment we're born, or the moment the universe came into being. There would be these tracks that energy was moving. There probably are these tracks that energy is moving along, and it is all absolutely mathematically preordained. Like, at a purely purely mechanical level. Now I am getting very heavy, actually. So anyway, I'm just throwing that out there. That there's this fantasy you have of people who escape, yes, escape the trauma.
Yes.
Do you think there are such people?
My fantasy would be that the few tribes that have, well, the very, very few tribes that have not been touched by modern man.
But then you got to factor in these ancient primitive, right, tribes who cut their penises in half and
right,
attached them to their nipples. Like, that
right,
can't be good.
Right, sure, good point. Okay. Yeah, so I fantasize that there's a tribe that doesn't do those practices, really in touch with everything, but it probably doesn't exist. But I like to fantasize that.
Your fantasy projects into the past rather than into the future, then, as in that there might someday be a pocket of society where child rearing and everything else is done just exactly right, and human beings,
yes,
can, you don't have that fantasy so much.
Oh, that too. Yes, I do. And, I have to say goodbye in just a few moments.
Okay.
Cause I have a client at, I was originally going to talk to you at my office, so I could have spoken for another 15 minutes, but I spoke to you at my house, so I have to drive to my office. Probably have to say goodbye in 5 minutes, but, I definitely, this is a whole nother conversation. One of the things we didn't get to it, but as a parent, I feel so torn about how to bring up my children, because I'm trying to do everything humanly possible to give them a non-traumatized, fully connected experience, and it has been crazy challenging on every level. I find myself engaging in some of the behaviors my parents engage in terms of anger, and obviously to much lesser degree, but still struggling with my unresolved stuff and it takes a lot of work also to, you know, I don't give them fluoride. So I schlep water from the store, you know, that's not fluoride, you know, reverse osmosis water. I don't vaccinate, and getting around vaccinations, both of my kids are adopted, and getting around vaccinations was insanely intense. And I could give 1,000 examples of how hard it is to be a parent who wants to not, I don't send them to regular school. It's so stressful.
That's sort of, it's ironic and even a bit tragic, isn't it? That it would add stress, that it would somehow be less stressful if you less concerned about being a good parent.
Correct. Mm. Yeah, I don't let them watch TV, and I mean all the good, you know, all the like holistic things that people do. Yes, if I vaccinated, if I let them have fluoride, if I let them watch TV, if I also did the practice that most parents do, which is let them cry it out at night to cry themselves to sleep, I would be so relieved.
But I wouldn't, though. I mean,
not
based
down.
On what so you said, yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, there would be a whole different order of stress going on if you were just, you know, saying fuck it every time you thought that you could help your children without fuck it.
Yes.
You know, I'll just do what I want. And that would, of course, be causing a whole different level of stress. So I would think, you know, I just want to end on a positive note that,
yes,
that the kind of, you know, the peace of mind that comes from knowing that we are at least attempting to,
yes,
to address our unconscious behaviors and hold a space in, yes, which they can kind of resolve themselves, that does bring about, that does reduce stress at a deeper level than all the,
yes,
surface bullshit.
Yes. Yes. In my heart of hearts, I feel so good about what I do. I have so many parents who say, oh, I'm violating my values. I shouldn't be letting my kids do X, Y, and Z, and I still do it. And I don't violate my values. I follow my values and I feel good about it. And so I don't know anyone who follows their values. I mean, this just sounds super cocky, but
no, I don't. I watch way too much TV, you know. So
yeah, so I don't know anyone who parents the same level of that I, you know, the way, you know, does all the things that I do. And I feel lonely in that, quite frankly. Like I'm part of like this screen free parenting group, and like all these people, you know, which I mean, not that the parents are screen free, but the kids are screen free. And
what's that mean, screen free?
That means my kids have zero access to anything electronic.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. That seems healthy. Until how old would you be?
I don't know, but I am going to go as long as I can, because yeah, I think they're dangerous for young minds.
Does that mean that you have to exempt from screens, or just not when they're around, only when they're not around?
So I've taken upon myself, I don't watch any videos, period. Unless it's for education, like literally like for school or something. And I also don't allow myself to watch anything without another person present. So my childhood aesthetic practices still influence me. And so I do let myself use a computer, obviously, but not around them, to answer your question.
Right. Well, as long as you don't become, you know, a monomaniac who thinks he's better than everyone else, then that would be the danger in living your values, I would say, just to end on a negative,
yes,
note. There's
right,
always, like the middle way is the healthy way for me, I think, because I've been,
sure,
both. I've been super
right,
indulgent and I've been super aesthetic. And,
sure.
You know, neither one really works.
Yes. So I'm trying to figure out how to live in the world and and honor these values and not be not think I'm better than everyone else. And I'm guilty of that, Jason. You know, I'm guilty of sometimes
same,
thinking that I got, you know, my values are awesome. Everyone else can.
Yeah. Well, everybody thinks that. So it'd be pretty weird if you weren't guilty of that.
So.